Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1192, I will have three segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, highlighting the Israeli genocide and catastrophic situation in the Gaza Strip. During the second segment, we will listen to Professor Ralph Wild, a top international law expert, with an analysis provided to Middle East Eye on the UN Security Council resolution that endorses US President Donald Trump's 20-point plan for Gaza, saying it is in breach of the fundamental norms of international law and is therefore legally invalid. In that analysis, Professor Wild says the UN resolution imposes illegal trusteeship over Palestinians, and he explains why Security Council Resolution 2803 is legally void. During the third segment, we will listen to a press conference held by CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, discussing a joint federal lawsuit with MLFA, the Muslim Legal Fund of America, against Texas Governor Greg Abbott for designating CARE a foreign terrorist and transnational criminal organization. We will hear from Edward Ahmed Mitchell, CARE National Deputy Director, and Charles Swift, MLFA's Department Head for Civil Litigation and Criminal Defense, and lead attorney in the lawsuit. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 776 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. In Gaza, Israel has continued to routinely kill and injure Palestinians in spite of the October 10th so-called ceasefire, while desperately needed humanitarian aid, including shelter materials, medicine, basic food items, and supplies for infrastructure repair, remain blocked, entrenching multiple catastrophes for Palestinians as the winter rains come. Israel's destruction of houses and buildings across the vague and invisible so-called yellow line has been ongoing, posing threats for Palestinians trying to return to their homes and property. Reporter Ibrahim Al-Salut filmed, quote, continuous gunfire accompanied by the sounds of explosions amid ongoing Israeli violations of the ceasefire agreement in areas east of Khan Yunis on Tuesday. On Wednesday, Israel conducted a series of airstrikes on multiple locations across Gaza. At least 32 Palestinians were killed, including 12 children, according to the health ministry. The attacks targeted Palestinian men, women, and children in tents and crowded shelters in the Zaytun and Shujaia neighborhoods of Gaza City. Reporter Faiz Osama posted this video to social media in the aftermath of an Israeli drone attack on a building housing displaced people in Shujaia, which killed at least six people. The spokesperson for the Gaza Civil Defense, Mahmoud Basal, was filmed by reporter Nahed Hajjaj at Al-Shifa Hospital on Wednesday as he held up the dead body of a little girl. Basal said, quote, when will these scenes end in Gaza? When will the scenes of our children being murdered end? How long will the scenes of murdering children in Gaza continue? These are our children being killed. What was their crime? Why do they get killed? Why are those who are preparing to sleep in the cold being killed? They were preparing to sleep in their mother's embrace, but they were killed. Israel killed them.
لماذا يقتل هؤلاء الذين تحضروا لأن يناموا في برد خارس؟ أرادوا أن يناموا بحضن أمهم لكنهم قتلوا.
Mahmoud Basal of the Civil Defense in Gaza. Al Jazeera reporter Hani Mahmoud stated that, quote, all of a sudden sounds of explosions, the presence of the drones in the skies, fighter jets that patrol the central and the eastern part of the Gaza Strip were all indications that this was a military campaign. In Khan Yunis, Israeli attacks targeted a group of people inside a UN building, killing at least three and injuring others. In addition to the dozens of Palestinians killed on Wednesday, the health ministry said, that at least 77 were injured in the series of air raids and tank shellings. On Tuesday, November 18th, a Palestinian was killed by Israeli sniper fire east of the Bureij refugee camp in central Gaza, according to Al Jazeera. The attack took place in the so-called safe zone beyond the yellow line, where Israel maintains military control. A similar attack happened on Monday when Israel killed two Palestinians, accusing them of crossing the so-called yellow line and posing a threat to Israeli forces. That same day, Israeli drones fired on a school sheltering displaced families in the Daraj neighborhood of Gaza City. Reporter Ahmed Al-Najjar said that at least 10 Palestinians were wounded in the attack, quote, during a ceasefire that never ceased Israel's fires. The Gaza government media office stated on Wednesday, before the series of attacks on Gaza City and Khan Yunis, that since the ceasefire agreement on October 10th, Israel had committed 393 violations, resulting in the deaths of 279 Palestinians and 652 injured. The deaths, injuries, and abductions of at least 35 Palestinians, the media office noted, quote, underscores the occupation's determination to undermine the agreement and create a bloody reality on the ground that threatens security and stability in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli occupation's attacks, the office added, have included 113 direct shooting incidents targeting civilians, homes, residential neighborhoods, and displaced persons' tents, 17 incursions by occupation vehicles into residential and agricultural areas crossing the temporary yellow line, 174 shelling and bombardment operations by land, air, and artillery, and 85 demolitions of homes and civilian infrastructure. This systematic crime aims to expand destruction and collectively punish the population, constituting a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions, the media office said. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated on November 10th that the continued massacres, attacks, destruction of homes, property, and land, continued prevention of the entry of food, humanitarian aid, and basic infrastructure materials are not isolated incidents, but, quote, part of a systematic pattern indicating a clear policy by the Israeli political and military leadership to use the ceasefire as a cover to continue genocide against Gaza's residents. By maintaining a disguised military assault and perpetuating killing, starvation, and systematic destruction, Israel exploits the absence of international will to protect civilians and hold perpetrators accountable. The human rights group warned, quote, of a grave development, the dismantling of the Gaza Strip's geographical unity, turning it into an isolated and uninhabitable area. This risks entrenching a permanent geographical and demographic division and pushing the population toward forced displacement as the only means of survival. Winter rains and flooding have exacerbated the humanitarian and health crises across Gaza this week. Beginning on November 14th, more than 18,000 households in Gaza were affected by the rain and floods, according to the UN. Quote, thousands lost their shelters, had their belongings damaged, or were again displaced. This number continues to increase as partners complete additional assessments to gauge the extent of the damage caused by the storm, the UN said. The Gaza government media office stated on November 17th that people are facing their third winter since the genocide began, quote, without protection. The Gaza Strip is witnessing an unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe, with more than 288,000 Palestinian families living through a harsh ordeal amidst severe weather conditions and a complete absence of the minimum requirements for survival, the media office noted. Quote, what we have repeatedly warned against has become a painful reality. Tens of thousands of tents sheltering hundreds of thousands of displaced people were flooded with the first storm of this winter, a scene that embodies the scale of the suffering and the international community's failure to provide adequate shelter. We have clearly stated that the Gaza Strip needs 300,000 tents and mobile homes to ensure basic human shelter, yet the world has not acted as required. The office stated that the Israelis have continued to also prevent the entry of flooring materials to protect the bottoms of tents and blankets, mattresses and thermal insulation materials, as well as mobile health clinics with water and sanitation services and lighting and alternative energy supplies. Since October 10th, at least 9 attempts by the United Nations and its partners to bring in tents have been rejected, the UN Humanitarian Office stated on Monday. The international charity Save the Children stated on November 18th that, quote, children in Gaza are sleeping on the bare ground with no shelter in flimsy shorts and t-shirts that are sodden with sewage water after their tents flooded in a weekend of heavy rains, putting them at risk of disease. The media manager at Save the Children in Gaza said that on November 14th, quote, people woke up and found themselves submerged in sewage water. We've had 2 years of living in tents, and they are already worn out. They cannot withstand the wind or the rain. I saw a woman with a six-month-old baby carrying her, running around, screaming, where shall I go? According to data from the shelter cluster of aid organizations in Gaza, more than two-thirds of Gaza's children, about 700,000, are exposed to similar risks, living in tents that are falling apart after 2 years of bombardment and displacement, Save the Children added. And since the announcement of the first phase of the so-called ceasefire agreement in October, more than 63,000 tents, 803,000 tarpaulins, and 278,000 bedding kits remain stuck at the boundary crossings. The Israelis have also banned the entry of timber and tool kits due to restrictions on what Israeli authorities consider dual-use items, the agency said. Quote, without tools and equipment, people are unable to start repairs to homes and many are scared to move due to unexploded ordnance, already causing child casualties or the fear of further airstrikes. Most people are still sheltering in whatever is left of tents used over the past 2 years, sewing blankets or any other materials they can find to patch up holes, Save the Children stated. And despite seeing more items in the markets, blankets, mattresses, and new clothing are almost nowhere to be found. And children are still wearing summer clothes, like shorts and t-shirts, most of them barefoot. Quote, with families desperate for the basics to survive, they spend what little they have on food rather than new clothes, the group said. Dozens of Palestinian medical patients who were receiving treatment in hospitals in occupied Jerusalem returned to Gaza this week through the Kerem Abu Salem or Kerem Shalom crossing. Our contributor Donya Abu Sitta recorded this video of families awaiting their loved ones who traveled on buses arriving in Khan Yunis. Amid the joy and relief of their families, these patients come back to a landscape of utter destruction and a collapsed healthcare system with limited access to basic medication and treatments. Donya sent us this short report by voice message on Wednesday.
Imagine leaving your home for just a few days to seek medical treatment, only to be separated from your family for 2 years. While you are away, they live under bombing and fire, moving from one tent to another, facing hunger, fear, and genocide. This is not fiction. It's the reality of dozens, perhaps hundreds of families from Gaza who left for treatment in hospitals in the West Bank before the war began. Then the border closed, and they become watching the news with a broken heart. On last Monday, I was studying by the light of my laptop screen, as we do in Gaza, since electricity has been cut off for 2 years. When I heard loud cheering from Nasser Hospital, I stepped out into the window and saw a crowd joyfully chanting. I thought it were welcoming home released prisoners, but the surprise came the next day. They weren't prisoners. They were patients who had finally returned to Gaza after 2 years of celebration, pain, and waiting. Imagine returning to your city, which you left carrying only the pain of your illnesses, and finding it only rubble. Imagine looking for your home and finding nothing. Look for your sibling, but not seeing them. Searching for your mother and finding her buried under the rubble. These stories are not exception. They are chapters in ongoing tragedy. Their story deserves to be written, read, and heard.
Our contributor Donya Abu Sitta reporting from Khan Yunis. Meanwhile, my colleague Ali Abunima reported this week that Palestinians from Gaza, recently released from Israeli detention, have given harrowing descriptions of sexual torture by their Israeli captors. He writes, quote, victims described rapes by groups of soldiers, forced stripping, forced filming, and sexual assaults, and rapes using objects and dogs. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, which collected the testimonies in recent weeks, said they reflect a systematic policy as part of Israel's genocide, rather than isolated incidents. Thousands of Palestinians are still in detention camps and prisons to which international monitors, including the Red Cross, have no access. These detainees were arrested solely for being residents of the Gaza Strip as part of a policy of collective punishment designed to humiliate Palestinians and inflict maximum psychological and physical harm on them, PCHR said. The group published harrowing, detailed testimonies of four victims, which I will not read here. In May, PCHR published a detailed report based on the accounts of 100 former detainees, documenting brutal physical and psychological torture. For more, read Ali Abonima's report, Palestinians Recount Gang Rapes by Israeli Soldiers, Dogs, on electronicintifada.net. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces carried out attacks in the village of Beit Omar, north of Al-Khalil, or Hebron, on Tuesday and Wednesday. The Wafa news agency reported that Israeli occupation forces enforced a full curfew on Tuesday after declaring the area a closed military zone. Middle East Monitor said that the Israeli siege was imposed hours, quote, after an Israeli settler was killed and three others were wounded, one critically, in a ramming and stabbing attack at the Gush Etzion settlement junction in the southern West Bank. The attack was carried out by two Palestinians, one of them from Beit Omar, who were shot dead by Israeli forces. Mohammed Awad, a local media activist, told Wafa news agency that the army prevented residents, ambulance crews, and other vehicles from moving within the town. According to Awad, Israeli soldiers took over more than 15 homes in several neighborhoods, positioning snipers on rooftops. The army also intensified their patrols, particularly inside the town center, where they prevented worshippers from reaching the mosques. At dawn, the Israeli army carried out a large-scale arrest campaign, detaining around 150 residents. The detainees were taken to a local school, where they were held and interrogated before being released hours later. Israeli soldiers also continued to enforce tight restrictions on all roads leading to the city of Al-Khalil, as well as on several of its surrounding towns and refugee camps. This comes after the army shot at residents in the northern town of Tulkarem on Tuesday, during a demonstration where Palestinians demanded the right to return to their homes in the Nur Shams refugee camp. Israeli forces have imposed a 10-month-long siege on the camp. Al Jazeera cameraman Fadi Yassin was shot and injured by Israeli forces while covering the protest. Yassin said that after the residents were displaced 10 months ago, quote, "The refugees feel let down by everyone." He said he had been standing to the side of the protest, filming with a colleague before going for some interviews. Quote, "A soldier was shooting in the air. He then aimed for my legs. The bullet entered my left leg and exited my right." A 12-year-old child was reportedly also shot and injured, leaving shrapnel in his neck. Al Jazeera said that the army renewed the closure of the camp and barred anyone from entering. Other invasions by the Israeli army were reported in Hizma, Qalqilya, and Al-Luban al-Sharqiya in the recent days. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers burned a house and vehicles and injured a number of Palestinians in the town of Sa'ir in the southern West Bank on Monday. Wafa news agency said that the settlers assaulted Palestinians with batons and sharp objects under the protection of Israeli soldiers, who blocked fire engines and ambulances from reaching the area. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Israel Killed Their Four Children by Ahmad Sbeh, writing from Gaza. Iman al-Husari, 21, refused to leave her home in Gaza City's Beach refugee camp when the Israeli army dropped evacuation leaflets in early September. "I would tell her to at least pack our backpacks and be ready in case of an emergency," Amal al-Husari, Iman's mother, told the Electronic Intifada. Iman would reply that she won't even leave her room. Having failed before in October 2023 and 2024, Israel was preparing yet again to invade and occupy Gaza City and had ordered all the city's residents to evacuate south. Iman's brothers, Fuad, Osama, and Bilal, were also resolute in rejecting the Israeli military's orders. "Not one of my children agreed to the idea of evacuating," Amal, 50, said. The children's determination mirrored that of their parents. Amal and her husband Mohammed al-Husari, 55, a taxi driver, were also determined to remain in their home in the camp. None of them wanted to again experience what Mohammed described as the suffering of displacement. In early October 2023, when the Israeli army first ordered all of the northern Gaza Strip emptied, the family packed only a small bag and evacuated to Rafah in the south. That winter, water leaked into the tent, and the family felt constantly cold. By contrast, the scorching heat in summer, Mohammed said, would force them to spend most of the day out of the tent. "We evacuated only with our summer clothes," Amal said. "We thought it would be a week or so before we could return." But the family's displacement stretched into a year and 4 months before they could return following the two-month January ceasefire this year. Around 2:30 a.m. on September 9th, Mohammed was jolted awake to the sound of a very loud explosion. It took a minute for him to realize he was under rubble, and for a moment he thought it was Judgment Day, he said. "There was fire, the heat was scorching, and the room filled with smoke. I couldn't see anyone," Mohammed told the Electronic Intifada. "I screamed for Amal. She replied, 'I'm under your legs.' I told Amal that I thought the children were martyred." The civil defense team came a short while later to look for survivors. Mohammed cried out for them while pounding on the concrete around him, he said. "Every minute, every second you remain under the rubble feels like dying a million times," he said. "There is no air, no oxygen, and you just want to die." Mohammed was rescued with injuries to his legs and back while Amal was pulled out unharmed. The two were taken to Al Ahli Arab Hospital. Hours later, at the hospital, a relative told Mohammed that some neighbors heard voices and that Iman and Osama were alive, but that rescue workers were still not able to pull them out. "I prayed that at least one of my children survived," he said, by now crying freely. It was pitch black when the bombing happened, and civil defense crews lacked the equipment needed to search or dig through the debris. They could not continue and had to return in the morning. By the time they came back, Amal said, if the children had still been alive, they would have already passed away. 10 other people from the wider Al-Husari family were killed that day, Mohammed's brothers and cousins. When the Israeli forces ordered civilians to flee south in early September, Fuad, like his siblings, told his mother that this time he would not leave home again. He didn't. He is still lying beneath the rubble of their house, beside his two younger brothers. It has still not been possible to retrieve the three bodies. Those are excerpts from Israel Killed Their Four Children by Ahmed Sabeh, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. Social media user Mahmoud Masri witnessed a wedding party in the streets on November 11th, saying, quote, "It's wonderful to see a wedding in Gaza for the first time in 2 years. Seeing my people happy again is truly heartwarming." And across Palestine, high school students celebrated the passing of their graduation exams, known as Tawjihi. In the Rifat al-Arir displacement camp, graduates were honored last week. The Samir Project, a mutual aid organization, stated that, quote, "Takroj al-Tawjihi is a big deal in Palestine, let alone when you study and graduate during a genocide. From no lights in the evening to bad internet, students in Gaza did the impossible to finish their high school degrees. The Rifat al-Arir camp is no different from other camps in Gaza today with the Tawjihi celebrations. Tears of joy and sweet distributions when the students got their grades, but also remembering and dedicating this moment of joy to our martyrs. The celebration is a reminder of hope, of a future for these young men and women, dreams of going to university and being a part of rebuilding Gaza in a liberated Palestine. One day we will get there," the Samir Project added. And our contributor, Asim Al-Nabih, who is the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality and a new correspondent for Al Arabi TV, Asim says, quote, "3 months ago, I wrote an article about my sister Nesma titled, 'What My Sister Teaches Me About Survival.' That story was published on the Electronic Intifada in September." Asim wrote that, quote, "Over the past 2 years, Nesma has studied without the basic conditions that any student needs to succeed. Yet she presses on, teaching herself, helping younger children in the family to read and write, telling them bedtime stories and refusing to let the genocide erase her future. This determination is not just resilience, it is resistance. Israel has tried to erase every element of normal life, cutting electricity, bombing schools and universities, killing teachers and students alike. Yet, like Nesma, thousands of children continue to learn, defying the logic of war that seeks to break their spirit. In this context, studying is a revolutionary act, Asim wrote. And on November 13th, Asim posted to social media that, quote, today her exam results were released. She scored 99.4%, ranking first in Gaza City. She has survived five wars and a genocide and still emerged at the very top. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. With the ongoing genocide in the Gaza Strip, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, alongside 20 other members of Congress, introduced on November 14, 2025, House Resolution 876, recognizing the genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza. This resolution officially recognizes that the Israeli government has committed the crime of genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza and calls for the United States to take immediate, concrete action to fulfill its binding legal obligations as a party to the Genocide Convention to prevent and punish the crime of genocide. I have a link to House Resolution 876 on our website, arabvoices.net. The United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 2803 on November 17, 2025, that endorses President Donald Trump's 20-point plan for Gaza, which backs the creation of an international force and places Trump in control of Gaza. Ralph Wild, a leading international law academic and practitioner, a professor of international law at the University College London, told Middle East Eye that the resolution attempts to codify trusteeship over Gaza, a colonial arrangement that breaches the Palestinians' right to self-determination. Wild spoke to Middle East Eye from Ramallah in the occupied Palestinian territories on November 19, 2025. Let's listen to his analysis.
The association of former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair with the Gaza trusteeship builds on the tradition of Western humanitarians who sought to humanize colonialism by grafting onto it a duty of care. Trusteeship assumes a world divided between childlike people deemed incapable of looking after themselves, a characterization now applied to the Palestinian people of Gaza, and the supposed adults, Donald Trump, Tony Blair, and others. At the heart of this model is racism. My name is Ralph Wild. I am Professor of International Law at the Faculty of Laws of University College London, part of the University of London. Yesterday, the 17th of November 2025, the United Nations Security Council passed Security Council Resolution 2803, purporting to authorize a two-year trusteeship over Gaza. Today, I will explain how this shameful act follows a long tradition in international diplomacy. I'm speaking in Ramallah, Palestine, in a personal capacity only. The Gaza trusteeship would replace the more than half-century-long occupation by Israel, which has involved serious violations of fundamental rules of international law in its conduct. Racial discrimination, apartheid, torture, grave breaches of the laws of war, crimes against humanity, and genocide. At the heart of these rules of international law is the duty of trusteeship. Dominion by the trustee, Israel, should be exercised selflessly in the interests of the ostensible beneficiary, the Palestinians of Gaza, not selfishly. There should be protection, not abuse. Befitting his role as an icon of Western liberal interventionism, the association of former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair with the Gaza trusteeship builds on the tradition of Western humanitarians who sought to humanize colonialism by grafting onto it a duty of care. This concept of trusteeship over people was adopted by Europeans for colonial rule over Africa at the Berlin Conference in the late 19th century, by the League of Nations after the First World War for the Mandate territories, including the Mandate here in Palestine, and by the United Nations after the Second World War for the Trust territories and all other non-settler colonies. Trusteeship assumes a world divided between childlike people deemed incapable of looking after themselves, a characterization now applied to the Palestinian people of Gaza, and the supposed adults, Donald Trump, Tony Blair, and others, who are deemed able to rule over not only their own people, but also others. Falling into the child category is the rationale for being subjected to trusteeship. In the League of Nations covenant, the people of the mandates were, and I quote, not yet able to stand by themselves under the strenuous conditions of the modern world, end of quote. The child-adult relationship is the rationale for the duty of care. The adult is in charge, but must act in the interest of the ward. The adult's responsibility is to bring up the child so that it will eventually attain maturity, to conduct tutelage, enabling development. The Gaza trusteeship will thus be temporary because it is transitional. The adults will build up local capacities for self-administration, the children will consequentially mature and attain adulthood, and the need for trusteeship will then end. At the heart of this model is racism. In the colonial era, a racist global standard of civilization, adopted within a system dominated by Europeans, determined who the adults and children were. No prizes for guessing who conceived themselves as the adults. Trusteeship was a self-serving sham, invoked in bad faith, serving as an alibi to rationalize colonial rule, which could now be justified as a civilizing mission. But the consequence of colonial liberation struggles after the Second World War, the end of formal colonization for non-settler colonies, was the adoption in international law of the right of self-determination. This was a repudiation of trusteeship. There were no more childlike and adult-like people in the world. The racist child-adult distinction between peoples was supposedly abolished. All peoples were equal and deserved freedom as adults. As the United Nations General Assembly stated 65 years ago next month, on the 14th of December 1960, and I quote, inadequacy of political, economic, social, or educational preparedness should never serve as a pretext for delaying independence, end of quote. Despite this, trusteeships continued, mostly conducted by international organizations, as in Bosnia and Herzegovina and East Timor, Timor-Leste. Global human rights rules were invoked as a seemingly non-racist standard of civilization that could determine, supposedly legitimately, where trusteeship was needed. International organizations were seen as capable of acting selflessly and thus performing the duty of trustee in good faith, in contrast to states. The US-led occupation of Iraq, bad. The UN in East Timor, good. And temporary arrangements, when actually followed, yes, East Timor, no, Bosnia and Herzegovina, were seen as genuine trusteeships, in that they didn't endlessly defer independence as the sham colonial versions had. I wrote a book on these arrangements and their antecedents in the colonial era. I am told that this book is being used as the manual for the Gaza trusteeship. This horrifies me. At the ICJ advisory opinion case last year, I had the privilege to argue for the League of Arab States based on my academic research that the Palestinian people had a legal entitlement to be free of the Israeli occupation without preconditions, and simply because of their right to self-rule, not because they were being treated abusively. In its landmark ruling last year, the court agreed. This was a conclusion about the right to self-determination, pure and simple, in and of itself. It would, therefore, apply equally to any form of foreign administration, however ostensibly humanitarian and time-limited. Replacing an abusive trustee with another form of trusteeship is not self-determination and would be illegal. We might be told that somehow this arrangement has been rendered lawful because the representatives of the Palestinian people have somehow agreed to it, just as supposedly Oslo legitimated the continuation of certain elements of the occupation here in the West Bank. But agreements brought about through an unlawful use of force, as this one has been, and contrary to peremptory or Jos Kogan's norms of international law, norms covering fundamental subject matter, which for this reason can't be limited by any other norms of international law, as this one is, the right of self-determination is a peremptory norm, such agreements are void. As I argued for the Arab League before the International Court of Justice, and also the International Criminal Court, also last year, the best approach in such situations is to say that such agreements may be enforced insofar as they are compatible with the peremptory legal rights of the Palestinian people. For example, if they are concerned with providing the resumption of urgently needed humanitarian aid, but those provisions which are not, such as permitting the trusteeship, are void. We might also be told that these illegalities have been somehow cured by UN Security Council 2803, which was passed yesterday. Indeed, a commonplace description of that resolution is that it has legalized the trusteeship. The Council did, in the past, purport to provide legal authority for those other trusteeships in Bosnia and Herzegovina and East Timor. Moreover, the Security Council does have the power in the United Nations Charter to provide legal authority for something that would otherwise be illegal, and for this to be binding on all member states of the UN who have accepted this by being parties to the UN Charter. The State of Palestine is not, of course, a UN member state, because the Security Council itself cannot agree, due to the threat of a US veto, to admit it. Moreover, in any case, the Council's power is limited. It can only act in a way that is compatible with the purposes and principles of the UN Charter. Those purposes and principles stipulate that the adjustment or settlement of disputes must take place, and I quote, in conformity with the principles of justice and international law, end of quote. As the trusteeship is not in conformity with the international legal rule of self-determination, and this legal rule has peremptory status, in purporting to authorize the trusteeship, the Council is acting beyond its lawful powers, ultra vires. As such, the authorization is legally void. This is the same problem the Palestinian people faced over a century ago when the Council of the League of Nations, very roughly speaking, equivalent to the UN Security Council, purported to vary the provisions of Article 22 of the League Covenant, which stipulated that Palestine was in a class of mandated territories that should be provisionally recognized as independent states, to instead permit the UK to retain control as trustee to implement the Balfour Declaration commitment to establishing a Jewish state here in Palestine. As I argued in my academic publications and before the International Court of Justice last year for the League of Arab States, the Council had no legal authority to bypass the covenant in this way, and, therefore, acted ultra vires. And so the authority it therefore attempted to give to the UK to implement Balfour was void. Just as then, trusteeship is back here in Palestine, and again, with a British character to it in the form of Tony Blair, so too, again, the executive organ of the global organization is attempting to legalize this by acting beyond the lawful limits of its constituent instrument. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. I will end by quoting from parts of the statement issued by the representatives of Hamas today in response to Security Council Resolution 2803 adopted yesterday, quotations of which accurately encapsulate what international law requires. And I quote, "This resolution does not meet the level of our Palestinian people's political and humanitarian demands and rights. The resolution imposes an international guardianship mechanism on the Gaza Strip, which our people and their factions reject. We call on the international community and the Security Council to uphold the international law and humanitarian values, and to adopt resolutions that achieve justice for Gaza and the Palestinian cause through the actual cessation of the brutal genocidal war on Gaza, reconstruction, ending the occupation, and enabling our people to self-determination and establish their independent state with Jerusalem as its capital." End of quote. Thank you.
That was Ralph Wild, a leading international law academic and practitioner, speaking to Middle East Eye. More information about Middle East Eye is at MiddleEastEye.net. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Texas Governor Greg Abbott issued a proclamation on November 18, 2025, designating the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, the nation's largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization, as well as the Muslim Brotherhood, as foreign terrorist and transnational criminal organizations. The proclamation cites Texas law to prohibit both groups and their affiliates from purchasing or acquiring land in Texas. It authorizes state law enforcement agencies to pursue heightened enforcement measures, including asset forfeiture and potential criminal penalties. It claims that CARE's goal is to forcibly impose Sharia law and establish Islam's mastership of the world, and that CARE has ties to Hamas, which is a U.S. federally designated terrorist group. CARE has strongly condemned the action, calling it a publicity stunt masquerading as a proclamation that has no basis in fact or law. The organization stated the governor does not have the unilateral authority to label American institutions as terrorist groups, as neither CARE nor the Muslim Brotherhood is designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the U.S. government. Many politicians, organizations, and individuals condemned the proclamation and defended CARE and its work over the years. On November 20, 2025, CARE filed a federal lawsuit against Governor Abbott and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton to block the enforcement of the proclamation, arguing it is unconstitutional and defamatory. Let's listen to a portion of a press conference CARE held on November 20th after filing the federal lawsuit, discussing that lawsuit with MLFA, the Muslim Legal Fund of America. We will hear from Edward Ahmed Mitchell, CARE National Deputy Director, and Charles Swift, MLFA's Department Head for Civil Litigation and Criminal Defense and lead attorney in the lawsuit.
As you all know, 2 days ago, Governor Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, issued a proclamation that was both defamatory and unconstitutional. This proclamation purported to smear our organization, the largest Muslim civil rights organization in the country, as a foreign terrorist organization, and also claimed that our organization can no longer purchase land in the state of Texas and will be subject to various other penalties. Now, Governor Abbott did this, even though he knows the Constitution does not allow any governor to target an American citizen or an American organization in this way. He did this even though he knows that he has tried several times before to violate the First Amendment, to silence critics of the Israeli government, and failed. Our organization, CARE, has sued Governor Abbott 3 different times in recent years to stop his attempts to flout the First Amendment, and we won each of those 3 times. The first time, the state of Texas tried to fire a special education teacher because she would not sign Governor Abbott's boycott pledge. This is a pledge in state contracts that requires Texans to say they will not boycott the Israeli government over its human rights abuses. She refused to sign. She was fired. We sued, and we won. A Muslim businessman in Texas was told he can no longer have a state contract because he also refused to sign Governor Abbott's Israel boycott pledge. His contract was canceled. We sued, and again, we won. And this year, Governor Abbott issued an executive order that essentially called on public universities to expel any students who dared to peacefully protest the Israeli government's genocide or even express support for Palestinian human rights. Again, we sued, and we won. The federal judge ruled that that law, that executive order, clearly appeared to be unconstitutional, and Greg Abbott backed off. He hasn't used it to expel a single student. So Greg Abbott is a consistent loser. He is someone who has repeatedly tried to violate our Constitution to protect a foreign government. And these attacks on CARE and on the American Muslim community and on Texas Muslims pose not only a threat to our community, but to all Americans. Because if a governor can throw away the First Amendment when he dislikes an organization or a faith community or a political cause, any governor could do it. They could target any organization on all sides of any issue. Black Lives Matter, Planned Parenthood, Right to Life. Any organization you could think of could be subject to baseless allegations and censure and closure if Governor Abbott can get away with this. That is why CARE and the Muslim Legal Fund of America today came together to file a lawsuit against Governor Abbott to make sure that his publicity stunt masquerading as a proclamation does not turn into actual government policy. Today, I'm going to introduce to you the lead attorney in this case, Charles Swift, the director of the Civil and Criminal Division at the Muslim Legal Fund of America. I'm going to briefly tell you about Mr. Swift, though many of you may know him already. Charles Swift is, as I said, the criminal department, civil department head at MLFA's legal division. He was named by the National Law Review as one of the top 100 legal minds in the nation. He is a retired lieutenant colonel, lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy, Judge Advocate General's Corps. Charles is known for winning the U.S. Supreme Court case Hamdan v. Rumsfeld for his client, Salim Ahmed Hamdan, a case that made history in the United States. Following his military career, Mr. Swift was a visiting professor and head of the humanitarian law clinic at Emory University School of Law in Atlanta, Georgia, before he entered private practice. Mr. Swift has been a steadfast defender of free speech, of human rights, of due process for all Americans, and we're very happy to have him involved in this case. And we thank our friends at MLFA for partnering with CARES Legal Defense Fund to file this lawsuit. With that, I want to turn it over to Mr. Swift to tell us a bit about this lawsuit, the cause of action in it, and what he expects to happen next. Mr. Swift, the floor is yours.
Thank you. And it is our great pleasure to partner with CARE, because CARE is the leading voice in this space. And we are absolutely at MLFA and myself personally devoted to defending those voices and to protecting the ability to continue to speak. And the threat that is posed by this unconstitutional action is a significant threat as set forth. Now, the lawsuit, basically what the governor did was unconstitutional for a multitude of reasons. Sometimes, usually there's only one, but he went for a significant number. The first was that because he has erroneously designated CARE a foreign organization, he's entered into the exclusive realm of the federal government. Under the Supremacy Clause and well-established case law set out in our brief or in our complaint, the federal government alone controls foreign sanctions. Governor Abbott decided to appropriate that power to himself to retaliate against CARE. The next part on it that's wrong in it is, of course, CARE is actually, and their affiliates in Texas, which are the actual plaintiffs in this suit, are all U.S. corporations. And U.S. persons in all parts, right? And of course, U.S. persons and U.S. corporations are entitled to due process of law, something that has been extraordinarily lacking up to this point, and it's in the was none. So he violated the Fifth Amendment as well as the Supremacy Clause. And then we can turn to the parts where clearly at this point, having CARE sued him successfully multiple times and trying to silence them, all of the allegations, when one looks at the allegations in part, are years and years old. They don't actually. Many of them are untrue. The few of them that have some factual basis establish nothing. Why does he bring it up now? Well, CARE's just won 3 lawsuits. So let's see if we can get them to stop talking and stop standing up for rights. So the last 4 accounts deal with CARE's ability to speak, their ability to assemble, and their ability to do so free from government retaliation. And that sets out what the lawsuit is. Our next step will be to seek a temporary injunction and then a permanent injunction from this law ever going into force.
Thank you, Mr. Swift, for that very clear summary. And it's so simple that it's remarkable that the governor decided to violate the Constitution in such a very flagrant way. But again, he's done it before, done it again now. He's lost before, and God willing, he will lose again now. Mr. Swift, you know, put this into context for us. You've seen many incidents of violations of the rights of American citizens by various levels of government. You know, tell us a bit about your perception of the time we're living in and the threat to due process rights.
I always hesitate to say something. I'm a student of history, and I hesitate to call things unprecedented. But this is getting pretty close to unprecedented. And the reason I say that is that, to my knowledge, no governor that we were able to find has ever sought to, you know, after there was established case law, the Supreme Court's ruled, then said, oh, I think I will appropriate the foreign powers. And never under such a, how should I say this, clear reprisal. This is a period of time in our government where when you speak against the government is trying to take action against you. And as we can see in a lot of those actions, they're bending the law, they're breaking the law, they're ignoring the law. And this one does all 3, bends, breaks, and ignores. And so I do think that it's not a coincidence that CARE was targeted. They've been a real thorn inside, standing up for what are clear free speech rights, things that I think we could, you know, I've always looked at this. I don't have to agree with everything that's done or said, but what's most important is that you have the right to say and hold your opinion, and a free speech, and particularly political speech, and open access to the courts is what is critical in making this society truly free.
Absolutely, Mr. Swift. So with that, we are going to bring in the media just a moment. The one thing I want to say before we do that to take any questions that reporters may have is the following. To the American Muslim community and to our partners and our neighbors, we want to thank you so much for speaking out vocally against what Governor Abbott did. We've seen statements from a multitude of organizations, civil rights groups, community groups, elected officials. I want to say that you all have shown that free speech still matters in this country. Civil rights still matter. Due process still matters. So whether it's the ACLU of Texas, 27 state legislatures in the state Texas House, members of Congress, various civil rights groups representing diverse communities, we commend you all for speaking up and expressing solidarity with us as we confront this unconstitutional attack on not only us, but all Americans and our right to organize and speak freely. As you know, CARE has been doing this work for 31 years, and our job is to be a shield for the American Muslim community, to protect our community from discrimination, bigotry, and to protect the rights of everyone in this country. And when you are a shield, you take arrows sometimes. That's part of the job. And we looked at civil rights organizations that came before us that were targeted in very similar ways. In the 1960s, the NAACP was smeared repeatedly. So were other Black civil rights groups. They were called communists, agents of the Soviet Union, un-American. Alabama tried to shut down the NAACP. And this happened because segregationists and racists couldn't win the argument. They didn't have a winning message, so they tried to silence the messenger. They failed then, and God willing, they will fail now. The opposition we face today is a combination of anti-Muslim hate groups, anti-Palestinian racists, and pro-Israel lobby groups who cannot win the argument, who cannot justify oppression, apartheid, or genocide, and therefore want to silence Americans who are critical of those human rights abuses. CARE has spent 31 years advocating for free speech, religious freedom, and promoting justice for all. We've done this with support from the American people for the American people. Despite all the conspiracy theories, CARE is an American organization, period. We've never been an offshoot, a partner, an agent, a pen pal of any foreign organization, not the Muslim Brotherhood, not Hamas, not Spectre, not Cobra, not anyone you want to imagine. These conspiracy theories that Governor Abbott is relying on are ludicrous. And that's another reason why he's going to fail. He is going to fail because he doesn't have a leg to stand on. We beat him three times before. God willing, we look forward to beating him one more time and protecting the rights of all Americans. With that, I want to open up to questions from any reporters who may want to ask us anything.
Hi there. My name is Michael. I'm a reporter with WOAI News in Texas. Thank you for doing this and helping us reporters cover this story. In addition to the terror designation that the governor has also issued a warning about Sharia law in Texas. He shot a letter to North Texas lawmakers and sheriffs warning about Sharia law courts, making them sound nefarious. For people who don't understand what Sharia law tribunals might be, can you explain this?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. So first and foremost, the fact that Governor Abbott is telling law enforcement officers to take time away from fighting real crime to investigate conspiracy theories about, quote unquote, Sharia law is another sign that he is increasingly desperate and I would say unhinged. Number one, Sharia is an Arabic word that can be translated as the way. It refers to the rules that Muslims follow. And it's very similar to halakha or to canon law, halakha being the rules that the Jewish community follows, canon law being what Catholics follow. Those are the rules of the Islamic faith. So when a Muslim prays five times a day, when a Muslim fasts in Ramadan, when a Muslim gives in charity, at least annually, when a Muslim declines to eat pork or drink alcohol or charge interest on a loan, they are doing that and following Sharia, which is Islamic rules. So I hate to scare Governor Abbott, but right now across the state of Texas and across the country, American Muslims are practicing Islam freely. That's their right to do that. Just as Jewish Americans are following halakha and canon law, Muslims are following the rules of Islam. Now, there are rules of Sharia that a government could implement in a Muslim country. Those rules have no application whatsoever in America, obviously, just like the rules of the Bible that relate to what a government would do have no application in America. And no one is trying to impose Islamic law on America, obviously. The idea that 6 million American Muslims would impose Islamic law on 300 million other Americans is insane. And the fact that Governor Abbott is relying on this shows how weak his argument is. This conspiracy theory is used by anti-Muslim extremists to whip up fear of Muslims. And in Governor Abbott's case, he is whipping up this fear because he wants to silence Muslims, because so many American Muslims have been critical of the Israeli government. Greg Abbott is an Israel-first politician. His primary goal is to protect the Israeli government from criticism. He knows that American Muslims and college kids of various backgrounds have been very effective in speaking up against unconditional U.S. support for the Israeli government. And so, again, he can't win the argument. He doesn't have a winning message. So instead, he says, well, they want to impose Sharia on us, right? Nonsense. It's not true. American Muslims practice Islam freely. That's our right. We will continue to do it, regardless of what Greg Abbott thinks. God willing. And one other thing I will add regarding the Sharia courts thing, this is important. So across America, there is such a thing as private arbitration. So oftentimes you'll see businesses, you'll see families, individuals voluntarily choose to go to private arbitration or resolve a dispute with a private mediator. This happens all the time in America. It's perfectly legal. It's perfectly permissible. And when an arbitrator makes a decision between two parties, that decision can only be upheld by a real court of law. And courts of law only uphold arbitrary decisions if those decisions don't violate the law or public policy. So to the extent that Governor Abbott, with this Sharia court nonsense, is actually trying to talk about private arbitration, there are already laws in place to make sure that private arbitrators, whether arbitrating a business dispute, a family dispute, a contract dispute, have to follow the law and have to follow public policy. So again, this order is a solution in search of a problem. So that's the other thing I would note there. One other thing I'll add, Mr. Swift, and this is the great ironic thing, is that Governor Abbott calls us terrorists. It's Governor Abbott that supported genocide in Gaza. It's Governor Abbott that has no problem with an insurrection in the United States. Kara spent 31 years consistently condemning all forms of unjust violence, whether that's hate crimes, terrorism, ethnic cleansing, genocide. It was CARE that was condemning Hamas suicide bombings way back in the 1990s. It's CARE that condemned attacks on civilians on October 7th. And yes, because of moral consistency, it's CARE that also has condemned the Israeli government's decades of oppression and violence against the Palestinian people, culminating in the genocide in Gaza. We have condemned terrorism so often that ISIS once put our executive director on a target list. Just you have to understand that. We have condemned terrorism so often that real terrorists once endangered our leadership. And so the idea that Governor Abbott's going to claim that CARE, an American Muslim civil rights group, is somehow a foreign terrorist group, it's patently ludicrous. And it's the clearest example of bigotry that you call a Muslim who you disagree with a terrorist. Governor Abbott knows better. And again, this is all part of his game to protect the Israeli government from criticism.
What you just heard was a portion of a press conference the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, the nation's largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization, held after filing a joint federal lawsuit with the Muslim Legal Fund of America against Texas Governor Greg Abbott for designating CARE a foreign terrorist and transnational criminal organization. I have a link to the lawsuit document on our website, arabvoices.net. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the U.S. and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.